Great to have you with us for another edition of Garden Talk. Larry Mueller here. And, you know, as we just learned from Alex Crow in our newscast, this changing climate is giving us more extreme weather, including heavy rains and storms, more of them. On Garden Talk today, we're looking at how to deal with more of these extreme weather events, especially the water events, with our guest V.J. Pandian back with us today, horticulture agent and educator for UW Extension in Kenosha, Milwaukee, and Racine counties. We'll talk to him about dealing with flooded gardens, and of course, we'd love to hear from you. Maybe it's about your flooded garden, or maybe it's another kind of insect, disease, or just a general question you might have about your garden. Give us a call. The number's 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. V.J. Pandian, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Oh, hello, Larry. Thank you so much for the invite. I'm glad to be here with the show.
Let's talk about the flooding you experienced in your area of the state. Lots of gardens affected, I'm imagining.
Yeah, it was unprecedented amount of rain in a short period. So it started in Saturday. It's like in my neighborhood, we got almost about 10 inches. And in other parts of Milwaukee, like close by Wauwatosa and those areas, got almost about 12 inches. But I also heard that surrounding counties, like parts of Ozaukee, Washington, Waukesha County, kind of got about a foot of rain, too. And these happened in a very short period of time. So what happened was that the soils are very saturated, very damp and wet. In many parts, you know, we have some flooding situation as well. Say there are backyard gardens, they are so wet, and hopefully, you know, in the next few days, it will start to dry out. But there are still some gardens which are in standing water situation, and that could pose a lot of issues for gardeners as well. Say, generally, when you do have these kind of flooding events, there are a lot of things we need to take in consideration, whether you live in your backyard, whether you have a garden in your backyard, or in an urban area, suburb, or rural. There are a lot of biological chemical contamination can take place, especially in a flooded event happens up. And oftentimes we don't think about chemical contamination, but we usually focus on biological one. For example, sewage water coming in, or maybe in a rural septic system, kind of over flooded. But there are a lot of chemical contaminations possible, including some petroleum products, heavy metals, even pesticides that we use, can also get into those flooded water situation. And these things could pose a lot of food safety risk in our garden. So something to think about, the impact that the floods can have in our garden.
Yeah, it's not only injuring the plants. I mean, if you were to eat those products, especially anything that was sitting in water, it'd be, I don't know if I'd want to do that.
Absolutely. We have a lot of bacteria, parasites, viruses. We heard in the news all the time about E. coli, Listeria, Salmonella, and all those things. Plus, on top of it, the chemicals, unknown amount of chemicals also get into it. So the very first thing is that if you do have any of those kind of produce that are submerged in the garden, or let's say even your garden has been submerged partially or completely, then do not actually, use those produce. Don't harvest those produce. You just toss them out. So it is very important to discard all those fruits and leafy vegetables that have been submerged or partially submerged, or even there are splashes of flood water happen to touch those produce. Get rid of those things, actually. But don't do it right now. Let the water dry out a little bit fast, okay? So you don't want to actually walk in the flooded water, or if the soil is too wet, don't walk in those kind of situations. So let the flood water recede as well as the water dry, the soil dries out a little bit. And then maybe, you can enter into your garden. And before you get into your garden, you know, either you can use some sort of like a rubber mat or a wooden plank or even like a, you know, flattened cardboard sheets can be used actually as a walkway to get into your garden. The key thing is that you don't want to compact your wet soil. Wet, soggy soil can also, when it gets highly compacted, can ruin your soil structure and can further, in a slow down any process of drainage happening out. So that's the reason why, you know, use some sort of like a wooden plank or a rubber mat to walk into your garden. And once you get into your garden, you know, first clean up any debris that you have, and then, you know, toss any of those fruits, you know, put those fruits actually in a garbage bag, any leafy vegetables in your garbage bag, and then get rid of those things actually. So these are some of the first safety thing you need to take into consideration.
And there's probably more we can talk about with our guest, Vijay Pandian. And you can join in. You may have a question that's unrelated to the wet. And I hope you'll join in. The number is 800-642-1234. Email to talk at WPR.org. And I think Joe in Windsor has a question that is unrelated. So let's go there. Joe, hi.
Hi, Larry. Thanks for taking the call. It is unrelated to the past call, but I had a question about my apple trees in the yard. We planted these a few years ago. We're finally getting to the point of bearing some fruit. And just recently in the last couple of weeks, I've noticed that there are more bugs and unfortunately wormholes now into the apple fruit. And so I was curious, what's the appropriate time of year that I should start to think about putting any type of pesticide spray onto the trees just to prevent this in the future? Thank you.
So that's a great question, Joel. So at this time of the season, when the fruit's starting to get mature, you would want to see actually some holes either nearby the pedestal of the fruit or the, you know, the fruit hangs onto a small stalk right by that area. As well as you're going to see some sort of like a holes at the you know, the tail end of the fruit as well, and there might be a, you know, sometimes a frack coming out as well too, or sometimes you might see actually the fruits are highly misshaped, and you will see some lot of sunken spots as well too. So these are all some signs and indication that your fruit has been actually damaged by insects. There are three insects that does this damage. One is a codling moth. And one is a palm cucullio, other one is apple maggot. These three nemesis causes like significant economic damage, you know, to these crops. And so the codling moth is the one that actually, you know, does a damage to the tail end of the fruit that the frass comes out. And suddenly in the middle of the summertime, you'll see all the fruits dropping out because of that. If it's actually caused by the pedicel of the fruit, then probably it's due to plum cucullio insect. And say that insect also causes the fruit drop in the later the season. And the third one, all those misfigured type of fruits, you know, caused by apple maggot. So the timing is crucial to spray for these insects. It starts immediately after 75 to 80% of the petal fall has been dropping. Every 14 to 15 days, you need to keep spraying for it. And sometimes these are not practicable for homeowners. In those circumstances, apple bagging is the best strategy. So either you can use some sort of like a nylon stocking materials or paper bags or Ziploc bags, and you can bag those fruits actually when they are in a tiny nut stage, about like in a quarter inch stage, I would say, and you can bag those fruits. If you bag about 100 fruits, probably you're going to have, depends upon what type of bag and how firmly they're attached to those stalks, you're going to get about 50 to 60% in a success in it. So think about apple bagging. We do have an extensive fact sheet that talks about apple bagging technique. So just Google up apple bagging UW extension. You'll come across that.
Joe, there you go. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. You can join in, too. Number to call, 800-642-1234. Email to talk at WPR.org. David emailed to say they are trying to identify the species of grass used for lawns that creates a thick mat and an excellent lawn with few weeds. This grass turns brown in the winter and is the last grass lawn to turn green in the spring. Zoysia, maybe?
Zoysia grass. So Zoysia grass is typically advertised, actually, and it's one of those grasses that stays green throughout the summertime. That's true, but it is not hardy for Wisconsin. It is more for central part of United States, you know. So it'll stay green throughout the summertime, and then when we have our first hard freeze, they will turn brown. And depending upon how the winter condition is, and most of the time they will completely get collapsed or killed. And in the spring, it will turn completely brown. You won't see those grasses greening back. And say it has been falsely advertised sometimes as a fast-growing, lesser weeds. But unfortunately, it is not really hardy for Wisconsin. So if you're really looking for any type of grasses which are more for traffic tolerant, which are more for tough areas, say you can think about either using purely tall fescue, or sometimes you can also combine fine fescue mixture as well as in dry shaded area as well too. So, but don't use zoysia grass.
don't use not you're not going to like it. That's for sure. I had a question about standing water. This is part of an email, too. If you have standing water, should you try to drain it?
So you have an option where you can create some channels and to divert those water to a storm sewer system or any other lower laying areas, you're more welcome to do. Or perhaps you can wait actually for another few more days, 4 or 5 days, and you can let those water to naturally, drain out into your garden. So again, it all depends upon, how big of a garden you have, what kind of, features you have in your garden. So this is something you need to think about down the road. Maybe, these flooding, Larry, you mentioned about, all this climate crisis, and we're going to see some of these kind of extreme weather pattern happening up. So this kind of things about, maybe it is time for us to think about, bringing back those rain garden back again. So maybe trying to divert those water into the rain garden where we have a low-lying area and filled with all this native priority plants because they have a deeper root system and help in percolating those, water back into those, so into the ground. So again, but for time now, if you could be able to find an option to, divert those water by creating a channel, you're more welcome to do. Next few days, it's supposed to be in more than 80 degrees in southeast part of Wisconsin. So you can think more likely this water is going to actually evaporate or go infiltrate back into the soil.
Vijay Pandian, our guest today, horticulture extension educator for Kenosha, Milwaukee, and Racine counties. Questions for him about your garden, maybe your landscape, your trees, shrubs as well, give a call. The number 800-642-1234. Or email to talk at WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk on WPR News. Taking a look at your garden today with our guest, Vijay Pandian, horticulture educator for Kenosha, Milwaukee, and Racine counties. Give a call with your own questions about your landscape. Number to call, 800-642-1234, or you could email us the email address, talk@WPR.org. We had I was in Door County over the weekend when we had the severe water and wind that came through, and a lot of trees were, some were uprooted. In fact, my neighbor had, or a friend of mine had one fall on his roof of his house. But there was also a lot of limb damage to trees. Under those circumstances, what's the best approach, Vijay, when you've got injured limbs or broken off limbs?
Good question, Larry. So before you attempt to do anything by yourself, a pruning, if you have a broken limb or if the tree is actually leaning towards your house or to a driveway, the first thing I would suggest to call a certified arborist. So you can Google out Wisconsin Arborist Association. In their website, they have a list of certified arborists, for your area. you can hire them for a consultation. And the key thing is, okay, when you do have this kind of broken limb or a tree which has been structurally unstable because of the wind and storm damage, you need to carefully assess the entire tree, whether this tree is safe for your property, or just by pruning the limb is good enough, whether it's going to be back again, structurally stable. Those kind of assessment will be done by a certified arborist, and they will give you a detailed report about, you know, whether the tree is safe or is a hazardous, and what extent of hazardous, you know, degree this tree is going to be. So those kind of information is very pertinent if you do have a large size tree. And again, when pruning some of those broken limbs, you need to consider a few things. Trees are young trees. Do not prune it at this time. Call a certified arborist, okay, and see what they have to think about. If those branches, leaning branches, are actually, you know, seems to be more hazardous in nature, is going to be falling on your roof of your house, then they may, I suggest, actually, then they may do it by themselves and they put up a pruning plate on the cut end. But if there are young trees, probably then in that case, you can do it by yourself. Again, even though summer is not a great time to prune those trees, but if you have a branches which are kind of posing a lot of safety issue, then you can think about using a three-point cut method to prune some of the younger limbs on a young tree by yourself. But for a larger trees, and especially dealing with a larger limb, or any kind of like a structural issues on a big trees, call a certified arborist to perform those services for you.
Let's take a call. Mary in Delavan, thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
Oh, thank you for taking my call. I have noticed that there are an abundance of black-eyed Susans that have taken over my garden. And then I went on a nature walk this morning in Williams Bay, and they're all over there, too. And I don't know why they're spreading as much as they are. And I feel like I need to pull them because they're just taking over.
Yeah.
And I wonder if that was something people were noticing or if there's something. It's acting like an invasive, and I know it really isn't. But anyway,
yeah.
That's my
yeah.
question.
I mean, absolutely. I mean, you know, we do see a lot of some of the native prairie plants, including black-eyed Susan, even milkweeds, actually. You know, you can see if you do plant one common milkweed, suddenly within a few years, it will start to encroach into your landscape. So it is common that some of the native prairie plants can be very aggressive and can take over a small space of your landscape. And in those kind of circumstances, yes, you know, one thing you can do, you know, maybe after you're done with the flowering, cut off the flower head off if possible. And then probably in the next spring, if you want to divide them and, you know, you can try to control their population, you're more welcome to do so. So, yes, you know, absolutely, you know, you can be able to do whatever the management to control their population if it gets unchecked, yes.
Yeah, I was thinking about that milkweed, too, because it'll take over an area. And I have had, you know, you just kind of, oh, do I really want to get rid of that milkweed? Well, I pull a few.
Absolutely. I mean, the core thing is diversity is the main thing. You
know? Yeah.
You don't want to have it completely dominated by one species, you know, and if it gets to the extent, if it's going to be actually, you know, taking over more than 25% of your landscape, then, you know, you start to do some control measures. Try to check the population, yes.
Let's go to Kane in Madison. Kane, thank you for calling.
Hi. I have some English lavender that I grew from seed this year. Started it in January, and it finally germinated in May, but they're really tiny right now. I have about four of them in the ground. Maybe 6 inches by 6 inches, as well as two French lavender plants that are about three times the size of those. One is in a garden bed, and one is in its own container on our deck. And I was just wondering what the best practice is for lavender that young over the first winter. Should I bring it inside? Should I cover it? I'm not quite sure what to do.
Okay, that's a great question. I had a lavender plant, actually. You know, it was a newly introduced in the market last few years. It's called Sensation. And I was so thrilled to have this lavender. And I had the same kind of worry whether it's going to make it up through the winter or not. I make sure I plant it in the south side, you know, a little bit in a upland type of area. Oh, gosh, you know, the winter kills it.
Yeah.
I mean, I was so thrilled to have it. It was a spectacular, very fragrant lavender plant. Again, you know, there is no guarantee, especially when it comes to the lavender. It all depends upon how the winter is going to be. When we don't have enough snow cover and with a lot of fluctuating temperature, the chances are, you know, very minimum. But again, being said that, if you do have a very young lavender plant, okay, make sure you plant them in an upland area. They don't really like any wet seed. So well-drained soil is very key. At the same time, it needs to be full sun as well, too. And plant them at the early stage. Don't wait till about like late summer, early fall to plant them, because that doesn't give enough time for the roots to fully establish. So plant them, you know, in the spring. So even though it might be a little bit late, but if you want, you can still plant it. Make sure to give some enough water. Or probably what I would suggest to do is that, you know, you could actually store them in a container, put them back in a cold basement or an unheated garage and mulch it heavily. And in the following spring, you can also plant them too. That will also give you some better chance of success as well. So when it comes to lavender, English lavender or French lavender, say, again, it all depends upon the merciness of the Mother Nature, especially the winter.
Yeah. And if they've already been in the ground, they're small, but they've been in the ground for a month or so, do you just leave them there?
Leave them right up like it is. And then in about late fall, mulch it heavily and put up like a chicken wire or a rabbit fence around to it and hope for the best. You know, again, you know, last winter was quite unprecedented. We had actually a deep frost and cold temperature in the soil, even to about like 8 inches, where the temperature dropped down to 20 degrees, okay, at 8 inches. And that really can kill the lavender plant. So without any snow cover, you know, we're going to lose some of these type of marginally hardy plants. So just make sure you add some lot of wood chip mulch or like, you know, chopped leaf mulch around the base of the plant, about 6 to 8 inches, and wrap it up with a chicken wire.
Kane, thank you so much for calling. Appreciate it. Let's go to Craig in Sauk City. Hi, Craig.
Hi, Larry. How you doing?
Good. Appreciate the call.
Yeah, I appreciate the show. And I was calling about soysa grass. Now, 50 years ago, I bought our house on the hill, and it had very sandy soil, or we could say soily sand if you want. But basically, it was, you know, not so hot and lots of moles. Well, I found a couple areas of zoysia, and I just kind of treated them nice and watered them. And they expanded over the years to cover the whole hillside. And they, yes, it takes them a while to green up in the summer. They don't green up till June, really. But they survived, and the moles went away. Apparently, the moles don't like the zoysia. They went to other parts of the yard, which is okay. So I was kind of, you know, I'm wondering if it was maybe a different variety or something to survive 50 years and expanded quite well.
Yeah.
Absolutely. It could be something else because Georgia grass is a warm season turf grass. And, you know, it is a pretty much, you know, commonly used in the central part of the United States, you know, maybe beneath the Ohio and further down to southernmost part of Illinois area, but she, you know, it is not recommended for upper Midwest region. So even if you talk about 50 years ago, it might be very chance that it could be some other different varieties or something. So it typically doesn't last. I had some clients' cases where they introduced zoysia class like 6-7 years ago when I was in the Green Bay area, and they had the same issue why it did not green up back again, and it had a lot of these damages. So, again, you know, check again those varieties, you know, that might be different, I'm kind of guessing. Yeah. Or maybe you can send the grass sample to the UW Turf Diagnostic Lab to confirm if it's really zoysia grass or something else.
Interesting. Craig, thank you for calling. Appreciate it. Tom in Madison, your turn. Hi, Tom.
Good morning, Larry. I have a peach tree in my backyard that I did prune for height a year ago or in the winter. It was you know, probably 18 to 20 feet high. I've got it down probably to 15 to 16. But the problem I'm having is that all of the lower branches on this tree are so heavily laden with fruit that they are all bent over and actually touching the ground. You can't cut the lawn under the tree because it's all, you know, the leaves are, everything's down there on the ground. I'm kind of worried about mice coming to chow down on all the peaches. And frankly, I think I need to stand on a street corner with a bushel basket in a week or so and just hand them out to people.
Well, first of all, I'm really glad that you had a bumper harvest. Okay, so kudos to you on that. Second thing about is that maybe next year you may want to revisit again about training your peach trees. Pruning is one concept. Training those branches is another concept. Peaches are trained in an open center system where you have, like, you know, 3 to 5 scaffold branches radiating from the, you know, from the trunk, okay? We don't normally recommend a strong central leaders on the peaches, you know, those things. So, again, being said that, you know, currently, you know, you're having an issue, all these peaches hanging on the lower branches, but don't know what to do, and you're very much worried about, you know, some mice or something might come and chew on those things. So the first thing is that maybe, you know, see if there's a way you can able to use some sort of, like, you know, mesh materials or something to bag those peaches, okay, if that's possible. You know, see if that can happen. And maybe next in the springtime, you know, late winter, early spring, perhaps one, you can either prop those branches, you know, see you can able to, you know, instead of having going lowing in, what do we say that, you know, having a hanging out like this, like, you know, probably, you know, in a sunken format, you know, you can see if you can able to prop those branches to get some little more height to it, or probably you can able to think about pruning some of the lower branches and stimulating any other new scaffold branches coming out. So those are some of the ways you can able to think about. Generally, in any fruit trees, okay, many lower branches, which are less than about, like, you know, 3 to 4 feet, okay, they're considered as a temporary branches. Your ultimate goal is to increase the canopy height and a little bit more than 4 or 5 feet tall. So when it goes a little more than less than 3 feet, you need to think about pruning those lower branches.
I was thinking about my colleague, Clara Neipert, who has a very must be a great year for peaches, because she's got like 5 of peach trees and she's trying to give them away. Unfortunately, she has not brought any in for the rest of us to sample. But Tom, I was looking online to help her, and you can make a peach vinaigrette. That if you're looking for ways to use your peaches, you might consider making some peach vinaigrette, and then you can use those for holiday gifts. That was my suggestion to Clara. So we'll see if she follows through on it. Oh, my goodness. But apparently a great year for peaches. Our peach trees, I told her that probably next year she wouldn't have as many. That you have a year of abundance with some fruits, you'll get a year of abundance followed by not so many.
And say, now, apples tend to have this biennial type of one, and pears also tend to have this biennial fruiting. So if peaches, sometimes, yes, they do also. So if people who don't actually do any of those fruit thinning or flower thinning, so peaches tends to divert most of the energy next year in the following, mostly on the leaf production rather than the flower production. So if you thin your flowers and fruits on a regular basis every year, you're going to have in a throughout the, you know, consecutive years, you're going to have actually peaches. If not, it's going to skip 1 year after another year.
Okay. Ursula in Madison has a question, I believe. Let's go there. Hi, Ursula.
Hi there. I live in Madison. I've got a decent-sized backyard and put a fence in last year with slats that are pretty close together, foolishly hoping it would keep the rabbits out. But the rabbits love my backyard for some reason. And I'm just wondering if there are any plants I could plant around the perimeter, maybe strong smelling, I don't know, shrubs or perennials that seem to be repel rabbits.
I mean, I had the same issue too in my front yard. It's completely invaded by rabbits, you know. And I don't have any fences either. I mean, in a and say so one thing I use my strategy is actually to place some strong scented plants. For some reasons, rabbits don't like those kind of, you know, strong scented, you know, flowers or leaves or those kind of plants. So you can think about that, you know, from like Artemisia, monkwoods, you know, it's an excellent plant. You can also try, you know, I mean, of course, daylilies, you know, rabbits don't chew those things actually in my garden. And again, you know, there are a lot of strong scented plants, including lavenders can also be, which I said, you know, marginally hardy. They'll also be fine. So any of those strong scented plants, you know, it can be used. So check it out. I know on rabbit tolerant plants, you know, if you Google up and with you'll find tons of information on those kind of strong scented plants, perennial plants that can be used in your garden. Yeah.
Ursula, thank you for calling. Stephen in Eau Claire, your turn. Hi, Stephen.
Hello. I have two apple trees, not sure what variety they are, but one of them has a lot of apples on it. But the leaves are falling off and turning brown.
Yeah, this is another great year for apple scab diseases. So, you know, in Wisconsin, every time in the summertime, when the humidity goes up, you know, 50-60%, and with a lot of rains that we got, the apple disease, scab disease, which is very common, you will start to see those infection happening up even in late in the summer, late in the springtime. But oftentimes we don't notice those things only by midsummertime when the leaves start turning yellow and brown. They're all dropping out. Half a tree is like completely naked in those kind of situations. Then we feel that, oh, okay, you know, something is wrong with the tree. And quite often it is an apple scab disease. You can either send a photograph to Dr. Brian Huddleston Lab to confirm it. The other case, probably, you know, if it's more likely apple scab disease, you know, you can also Google up and see if the symptom matches with what you have. Too late to do anything right now. The best thing to do, probably, you know, next springtime, you can try to think about, you know, using some sort of fungicide to spray for it. At the same time, you know, in late fall, early summertime, you know, late fall, you can clean up actually your garden. Any fallen debris or something like that, you can clean up and compost it. Whether it's going to make any significant difference in reducing the spore for next year, it's not. But again, you know, you don't want to have the spore being accumulated in underneath the soil. So the key is the timing to spray. Usually it happens in the mid to late springtime when the first leaf emerges and the rain happens at the time. That's the time you need to spray for a fungicide. You see, it's too late right now to do anything at this stage.
Stephen, there you go. Thank you so much for calling. You can join in too at 800-642-1234 or email to talk at WPR.org. Perry emailed to say they have a home in northern Wisconsin near Iron Mountain, Michigan, actually, and they've been losing their red oak trees to oak wilt. Perry has followed all the pruning guidelines, but is there anything they can do to prevent it or stop it once it starts?
Well, first of all, yes, if you do now, actually, you know, you have an oak wilt disease happening up, make sure you get it confirmed through just sending the sample to Dr. Brian Huddleston Lab for testing for oak wilt. And once you get the confirmation, Brian Huddleston will give you actually a detailed information on how to manage it. So depending upon how big of a woodland areas you have, how much population of oak trees you have, so the management strategies varies. So, you know, usually you need to find out what are some of the healthy oak trees, how far it is from your infected oak trees. Maybe you can severe the, you can call a certified arborist and recruit them and help them to severe the roots from the infected oak trees to a healthy oak trees. And there are some preventive fungicides that can be used on a healthy oak trees. Again, those trunk-injected preventive fungicides can be applied only by a certified arborist. So Google up Wisconsin Arborist Association and go to their website and find out the list of certified arborists in your area and hire them to figure out the management strategies. If you have only a couple of oak trees in your backyard and if one oak tree has been infected and confirmed for sure, then probably, again, you need to call an arborist to cut down those oak trees and safely dispose of the infected wood. And then probably think about severing the root graft underneath the soil. And also, you can use a preventive fungicide, you know, injected on the tree trunk. So these are some of the management tools that certified arborists use, so call them.
Yeah, it's insidious. I mean, and those roots, they go a long way. You know, they'll go past the drip line of the tree, if I'm not mistaken.
Absolutely. And there are some, like, you know, observations that's been done. And, you know, again, it varies between species to species. So if you know what the height of the tree is, you multiply the height of the tree with a factor 1.5. That much radius the root can spread. So suddenly it goes a lot way beyond drip line area of your tree. So again, you know, severing those, you know, the root graft underneath the tree between the healthy oak tree root, which are the infected oak root, is very key because sometimes the oak wilt disease gets transmitted through the roots from infected one to the healthy one through those root graft area.
Yeah. BJ Pandian, our guest today, as we take a look at your lawn and garden and shrubs and trees, I hope you'll join in with your own questions. The number's 800-642-1234 or email to talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk on WPR News. You're listening to Garden Talk on WPR News. Larry Mueller here with my guest, VJ Pandian, Horticulture Extension Educator for Kenosha, Milwaukee, and Racine Counties. Give a call with your questions. The number is 800-642-1234 or email to talk@WPR.org. Stephen and Eau Claire up next. Stephen, what's on your mind? Oh, you know what? We have lost Stephen. let's take another question here. And this comes from actually a friend who has a maple tree that is dropping her leaves. They're already colored and falling off.
Well, that could be a lot of things could happen. And first thing, many maple trees, especially if it's a mature maple tree, 15, 20 years old, they all have an issue called, most of the trees, you know, back in the time, and even still sometimes, you know, we plant trees deeply. So the deep planting of the trees down the road, you know, causes a stem girdling root issue. What it means is that when your tree is planted deeply, some of the roots, you know, starve for oxygen, and they tend to come up, and then when they come up, to the surface, they actually girdle their own base of the trunk of the tree, and we call stem girdling root. The area that they girdle, that area, actually, you're going to start to see a decrease in the flow of nutrients and water uptake. So that particular section of the crown of the tree, you're going to see the leaves will turn into early fall coloration. Sometimes, you know, you're going to see a very thin canopy in that area. And over time, you're going to see some bad branches happening up as well, too. So if one half of a tree is turning, you know, in the early fall coloration, it's more likely a stem girdling root. Now, being said that, there are all other possibilities. Sometimes if that section of the, you know, area where the roots have been severely damaged, maybe a construction or sometimes anything happens up or your root pruning happens up, that can also further stresses the tree up and the canopy and causes some early fall coloration as well as wilting happening up and dieback happens up. So again, you know, I would really recommend your friend Larry to contact a certified arborist or send us a photograph for us to confirm whether it's a stem girdling root issue or not. And eventually they have to contact the arborist, see if the tree girdling root can be pruned and can be removed, or it is best to cut down the tree, you know. So again, you know, you need to have an arborist to do an on-site inspection to assess the severity of the girdling root impact.
Let's take a call from Nick in Green Bay next. Nick, hello, what's on your mind?
Hey, Larry, you seem to have the perfect guest at the right time. I've got a black thumb, so I don't want to touch this tree, but I got a pussy willow tree by my garage here, and it's a great shade tree, but it's getting pretty massive, and I really want to trim it back, but I don't want to hurt it. Are pussy willow trees pretty hardy? Like, if I trim this, am I going to kill this? Because it's big. It's, like, probably 30 feet tall and about 20 feet around. But it's, like, if you go from the garage to the porch, you're getting ants and everything else on you from the tree. And I'm standing in front of it, and it's just massive. But like I said, I don't want to hurt it because it's a great shade tree.
I mean, of course, willows are hardy for our area. Pussy willow is hardy for our area, okay? Now, you got bigger problems The reason I'm saying is that, okay, willows, including pussy willows or weeping willows, they get prone to a lot of things, not only from storm damages, but they have a very poor branching structure. So you're going to see some branch split happening up, trunk cracks happening up, or even some sort of cracks and crevices in the base of the trunk of the tree is going to be happening up. One of the good indications that, the internal part of the trunk or the branch has been decaying because of the crack and crevices is by ants. The ants tends to crawl back and forth, inside the trunk of the tree. It's a good indication that there are some internal decay happening, and these ants get attracted to some other juicy substance that's been exuded out from those, decay materials. So it's crawling back and forth and enjoying those juicy ones. But it's not a good, but it's a good sign for us to tell that their tree is not actually, in a great shape. Structurally, it's getting weaker and weaker. It's a matter of time. A storm may come in and knock down the tree and can cause some property damage. So before it happens, call a certified arborist to figure out how hazardous this tree is going to be. Either a simple pruning or it's best to get rid of the tree, the arborist will tell you. They will call, again, like I said to you with the previous caller, go to Wisconsin Arborist Association, and they will have in their website, find a professional certified arborist based on the zip code. They will have that link to it. Say you can use those links, hire a professional arborist to do actually a hazardous tree risk assessment. And based on that risk assessment, you can able to determine whether your tree can be temporarily saved or it's best to remove it in about a few years from down the road.
All right, Nick, there you go. Thank you for calling. Appreciate it. Bill in Eau Claire, we go to you. Hi, Bill. Bill, are you there?
Larry, I am. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
You can. I have a very straightforward question. Thanks for taking the call. Listening to the station, and I caught something of interest. You said the gentleman is familiar with the lawns and stuff like that. How do you get rid of clover in your lawn?
A lot of people are adding clover to the lawn.
The common Dutch white clover is gaining a lot of popularity nowadays because of, it attracts, pollinators. It's a pollinator-friendly plant, and there's a new concept of bee-friendly thing happening up. But if you are in a situation that you really need to get rid of the clover without killing your turf grass, there is a product with an ingredient by name called triclopyr. Now, the trade name is Weed Be Gone for clover and chickweed. You can get it actually in many box stores, I would say. Again, it's called Weed Be Gone for clover, chickweed, oxalis, all those things. And the ingredient is triclopyr. And so you can use this triclopyr product and you can spray it. Again, you may want to think about doing a follow-up spray again. All those instructions will be listed in the product label. So follow the label's safety and directions.
Bill, there you go. Thank you so much for calling. And clover is, I guess it's been popularized a bit because it does fix nitrogen in the soil.
Yeah, being in the legume family, it really fixes up, you know, the free atmospheric nitrogen back into the soil. And that really helps actually your turf grasses as well, too. And so, again, you know, instead of having a monoculture of the grass species, bring some more diversity, attracting pollinators, and being more environmental friendly, clovers have gained a lot of popularity. I mean, those days back in 1900s, what I've read in many literatures, back in those days, people used to have clover in their lawn. And then probably, I think, only in like 1950s or 60s, I think, you know, it became classified as a weed in the lawn. Now I think the trend is going back again, you know, trying to reintroduce clover, you know, so yes.
Yeah. Bill, thank you very much for calling. Let's go to Veronica in Wausau next. Hi, Veronica.
Well, hello.
What can we do for you?
I have a question. I love dahlias. So every year I try and plant a lot of dahlias. Is there something that I should do to the soil the year before I plant them to prepare for the next year's flowering season?
Well, one thing dahlias don't like is actually having a wet feet. So make sure the site that you're going to prep or your site you're going to select is actually a little bit more upland area, not in a loyal area. Second thing dahlias don't really like is heavy soil, because heavy soil, especially when we have rain or flood, it tends to hang those water and causes actually, you know, a rotting of the bulbs, the tubers. So in those kind of circumstances, make sure you plant your dahlia bulbs in a little bit upland area or in a raised beds or in a planter boxes and those kind of things. So before you do those things, mix your soil with a lot of good organic matter about 6 inches deep. So you can go to a garden store. You can get actually any of these organic matter like compost, rotten cow manure. All those are excellent ones. So you mix them into the soil very well, and then you can plant your dahlia bulb about 6 to 8 inches deep, and you know that you will have a pretty good success. I used to have dahlias in my planter boxes, and it grows amazingly very well, because one of the key things is that it was one of the wet year, but my dahlias did amazingly because, you know, being in a planter box, it drained out moisture as easy as possible. And the leaves and the plants there, the flower was so gorgeous. It was like a dining plate type of flower it had. So, yes.
Yeah. Veronica, thank you very much for calling. John in Boardman, your turn. Hi, John.
Hi, Larry. Say, I have a catalpa tree in my yard. I think we've had it for 12, 15 years. The last couple of years, it started to die back a little bit at the top. Some of the small branches are dying back. But this year, my wife and I noticed a few weeks ago, one of the major branches has, the leaves have browned and shriveled, are starting to drop off. And now the branch, next branch over, same thing. The leaves are browning, shriveling, dropping off. I know the internet says it could be something called vermicillium wilt, but I'm just wondering if your guest can suggest anything for a catalpa tree that's beginning to wane.
Yeah, so catalpa are highly prone to vermicillium wilt disease. So vermicillium wilt disease is a systemic disease, and it's a fungal disease that really blocks actually the water movement inside the tree. And during the midsummer time, you're going to see one branch collapsing down. In the next summer, you're going to see another branch collapsing down. So it's going to cause actually the branch collapse is going to be happening up in the midsummer time, especially when the trees are in need of water. So this vermicillium wilt disease is very common in catalpa. So first thing I would suggest is to take an infected branch and send it to the UW-Madison plant pathology lab for Dr. Brian Huddleston to get it tested and confirm if it's really vermicillium wilt or not. Say, once you get a confirmation, then probably either you can prune those dead branches, okay, and you can either burn it or you trash it, those dead branches. Don't tend to put it actually on the other branch. Don't chop it and put it on the other branches or other trees. And the second thing you need to think about actually is that eventually the tree is going to collapse because there's no fungicide to cure those infected trees.
Oh, so John, your tree may be on the way out. In the meantime, you can trim those branches. Our guest today, Vijay Pandian, will be with us right to the bottom of the hour, and we'll take a look at the news now, and then we'll be back with Vijay Pandian. Great to have you with us for this edition of Garden Talk. Larry Mueller here. In the last half hour of the show, we'll be talking about native plants and some courses that you might be able to sign up for relating to native plants. Right now, Vijay Pandian, horticulture extension educator for Kenosha, Milwaukee, and Racine counties, is answering all of your gardening questions. And I hope you'll join in at 800-642-1234 or email to talk at WPR.org. Let's go to Mary in Plover, Wisconsin next. Hi, Mary.
Hi there. I actually have a couple questions. Number one question is my cucumbers didn't do very well. I had more blossoms and more pollinators on them, but very few cucumbers. And then my second question is as I pull out plants from my garden, is buckwheat an okay thing to plant for ground cover in that garden before I get it all put to bed?
Okay.
Good question. And say cucumbers, more blossom, but no fruit. So two things could go wrong. One, when we do have extreme high temperatures, sometimes flower abortion could take place. It produced flowers, but most of the flowers could be male flowers and not female flowers, and that could actually cause cucumbers not producing any fruit. So if you are happen to have a cucumber plant next to any sides of your house or any concrete driveways or in a brick walls or anything, that could radiate the heat and can cause a spike in temperature about like, you know, 90 degrees or more than that. Sometimes most of the flowers could shift actually to predominantly to be more male flowers, and that could happen. So again, you know, so maybe think about, you know, where exactly you positioned your cucumber plant, and we can't absolutely control the weather conditions, okay? And so that's one thing. Now, buckwheat, you know, buckwheat is a great cover crop. And usually we use those buckwheats as a summer cover crop, which means that you have a fallow land and you don't want to plant, you know, you're not going to garden this year, and you don't hate to lose, you know, lose those topsoil by leaving it empty and being occupied by weeds. In those cases, buckwheat can be used, and you can see those buckwheats, and once they're done with the blooming, immediately after they're done with the blooming, you need to till those buckwheat back into the soil. Do not let it pass beyond the blooming stage, because if it does, it's going to produce seeds and it's going to buckwheat is going to become a weed in your garden. So, but it's a great cover crop which can be used as for organic material in the soil. Now, again, you know, every year we're starting to see some, you know, increase in fall conditions. So even though it is recommended for summertime, and if you want to seed it right now, within a matter of like 7 to 10 days, they should all germinate and should cover your soil very quickly. And it's a great magnet for pollinators, too, once it's in full bloom. But don't let it pass beyond the bloom.
All right. Mary, there you go. Thank you. Annie in Dalton, Wisconsin, your turn. Hi, Annie.
Hello. I bought some seed from my pals at Prairie Moon, and they arrived, I think it was in April when we still had fairly cool weather. So some of these I didn't put in, you know, I didn't scatter right away because I didn't want the soil to be too cold. I came across them a couple days ago. So here they're still sitting in my house. smooth blue asters and leafy prairie clovers. Can I spread that seed now, or should I wait for a more fall scattering?
Well, many prairie plants, they really like to have their seeds stratified. What it means is that, you know, they need to experience certain, weeks or months of cold temperature, moist, cold conditions for them to germinate. The temperature needs to be between 35 to 45 degrees, and they have specific number of hours to do that. So that's one of the reasons why many prairie plant seeds are best to be seeded in the fall time, so that, you know, they can, you know, experience the, you know, Wisconsin's natural stratification process, in, you know, introduced by Mother Nature by in the name of winter. But in the fall, as well as in the late spring, where it gets temperature, you know, gets starting to get a little bit more like, you know, 35 to 45 degrees Fahrenheit, and it, when it rains and the soil is moist, they get actually stratified, and that helps actually the seeds to break from its dormancy and starts to germinate. So I would wait till about like mid to late September to seed it, or even you can go even till about October to seed some of those prairie seeds. Now, thing about, you know, seeding many of these prairie plants is that, you know, they will germinate very well, but next in the springtime, it's hard to differentiate which is weed, which is a prairie plant, because they all look similar. So, which means that you really need to think about moving them down in the middle of probably summertime, probably big one in June, and then every month keep moving it down to control the weeds. As long as, you know, you keep your mowing height about 12 inches or above, 12 inches or below, you should be fine. And that will really help give a little bit of advantage for your prairie plant to, you know, to establish. And at the same time, it helps in keeping the weeds down. So, so wait till about fall to do those seeding of your prairie plants.
All right, Annie, thank you for calling. Let's go to Janice in Weyerhaeuser. Hi, Janice.
Hello. So glad to... for you to take my call. When I heard the theme of today, water in the gardens, I thought this is a perfect time to have this question. Why did 1/4 of my tomato plants blight? The garden is doing beautifully, but some of the plants, and it's not just the late blight like now with the yellow and brown, it's they turned brown, they died. Was that too much water? Was that not enough fertilizer? What was that? Thanks.
Well, oftentimes, you know, tomatoes are magnet for, you know, two diseases. One is called septoria leaf spot early blight. These two diseases love humidity. Wisconsin, you know, humidity, they love it. No matter what you do, whatever the crop rotation, whatever the, you know, where you place your plant, these two diseases starting to take place from the lower half of your plant and keep slowly, you know, getting up. So because the, most of the time, most of the bigger foliages are mostly concentrated on the lower half of the plant. So that's why you see one half of the plant looks fine, or the bottom half looks pretty much brown and yellowish in color. And that's because of these two diseases. So the key thing is proper yard movement around the plant is very essential. So when you plant your tomato plant, give copious amount of spacing, 4 to 5 feet spacing, especially if you have an indeterminate variety tomatoes, give a lot of spacing. And second of all, train your tomatoes, either in a cage system or in a trellis system. So let them grow up vertically. They can let them grow up so that they have a proper yard movement around those suckers and the branches. If you do have too much suckers, prune those suckers off, you know, so you don't want to have multiple zillion branches, you know. So you can limit it to about like, you know, a maximum of 4 to 5 or something like that. So give a proper training and pruning of your tomatoes, and give a lot of spacing. And probably, you know, if you already have the infected leaves, just, you know, rake it up from the soil and trash it. Too late to spray any type of fungicide, because most of the fungicide are preventive. So it needs to be taken place, you know, before the infection takes place. But maybe now it's too late.
Janice, there you go. Thank you very much for calling. Let's turn to Lee in Green Bay. Hi, Lee.
Hi there. I have 4 Accolade elms on my property that I planted well over 20 years ago. They're doing great. How is the Accolade Elm doing any information on resisting Dutch elm disease? And also with the oaks, what oaks would be more resistant to the oak wilt?
Mm-hmm. Great question. You know, we do also have Accolade Elms, Triumph Elms, and a lot of nowadays modern day elm varieties, cultivars, are tolerant or highly tolerant to Dutch elm disease. Now, none of the elms are resistant, so you need to know the difference between a tolerance and resistant, okay? A tolerant means that probably these elm varieties could actually, cultivars could be able to accept those diseases to a certain degree, but they will be fine, they will overwhelm those, you know, infection, and they'll still continue to keep growing. Resistant means completely they're immune to those infection, okay? Say we don't have a completely resistant to Dutch elm disease, okay? But our cultivars resistant to it. So Accolade Elm is one of those cultivars which are highly tolerant to the Dutch elm disease ones. But if you subject those elm trees to a very harsh situation, let's say in urban area, you stress them out because of lack of water or too much heat, too much salt, when these elm trees are stressed out quite a bit in those kind of urban situations due to lack of maintenance and lack of care, then they become highly vulnerable to Dutch elm disease as one, because they are more tolerant. Tolerance means doesn't mean they're completely immune. Now, when you're shifting gear to oak trees, okay, so in Wisconsin, we do have three different types. We have red oak, we have white oak, we have black oak. Black oaks are very rare. We don't find it throughout in Wisconsin, only in a very isolated part. Now, red oaks are highly vulnerable to oak wilt diseases. Within a single season, it can wipe out the entire oak tree once it gets infected. White oak groups, that includes your swamp white oak group, bur oak, all those English oak, white, other type of oaks, okay? They are more tolerant. That doesn't mean they are resistant. They are more tolerant, and they may take multiple seasons, you know, to kill them, okay? And again, it depends upon the healthiness, pre-existing healthiness of your oak tree. So yes, oak trees are also still, you know, vulnerable to oak wilt, including the white oaks.
Yeah. But if you've got your choice between a white or a red oak and you're worried about oak wilt, you may want to go with the white oak.
Absolutely. So you have a lot of selections, a lot of options to choose within a white oak group. Swamp white oak is an excellent one, and you can use those as a cross between a bur oak and white oak. You can use those, and it's more popular these days in the urban areas.
Yeah, we have a few white oaks on the UW-Madison campus. They're just beautiful, beautiful trees for sure. Lee, thank you so much for calling. You can join in, too, at 800-642-1234. Give us a call. We'll get you on pretty quickly. Cheryl in Superior emailed to say their garden association has a supplemental garden for the local food shelf. Their trees were pruned by an arborist last year. This year they bloomed, set fruit, and then the cherries dried up. Is it an insect problem or is it a problem for Dr. Death?
Well, of course, it may have to go to Dr. Brian Huddle's mouth about this inquiry. When cherries actually bloom and then immediately, after a few weeks, it starts to dry out, a lot of things could happen. One, at the time of the cherry blossom and immediately following that, if we happen to have a frost could also do that. Or probably if you do happen to have any canker diseases, and that canker disease infection could also, knock those blossoms out too as well. You will start to see some, oozing and gums happening up, from those branches and twigs. And that can actually cause the wilting of those branches that produce a blossom and causes the blossom to wilt and dry out. So I would highly encourage, the customer to send a sample to Brian Huddleston Lab to get it tested to figure out what exactly, the client is dealing with.
Dale in Tomahawk emailed to say tansy is taking over a lot of areas on their property. It's so thick in some areas, Dale can't even mow. it's 5 to 6 feet tall in some places and is practically a monoculture. Should Dale just use Roundup on it, or is there another way to control it?
Well, tansy is an invasive plant, and of course, you know, we do have tansies in Wisconsin, and so tansy is a more of a herbaceous perennial one, and it primarily spreads by seeds, and you can also sometimes find some like short rhizomes that also can produce by vegetatively as well too. So when you think about tansies to manage it, the first thing, don't let it to bloom. So you immediately move it right immediately after it's done with the blossom, or even if you don't care about the blossom, just mow it. So when you mow it exactly at the blooming time, probably they're going to actually lose quite a bit of energy, and then you can hit it up with some chemicals like that has been registered for controlling any broadleaf weeds. You can use those things, including like 2,4-D, triclopyr, dicamba. All these things can be used. Again, you know, mowing could be very effective, and you know, you can be more effective, about more than 50 to 60% more effective. So make sure to mow it when they are right at this blooming time. You can able to successfully manage it.
We have a question about phlox, and should you continue to or always deadhead phlox?
I never did that, deadheading at some slots. But, you know, phlox are one of those plants. They like to be planted in a mass in a grouping format in your landscape, so it looks more gorgeous. But in terms of deadheading them, I never did it personally by myself, but it's not going to pose any harm to the bush if you do want to do a deadheading.
I had heard, or somebody told me, that if you don't deadhead, the color that you have originally is going to change over time.
Mm. I never heard that before, Larry. So I know that from a purple color to white color, you know. I never heard that, but I don't know what is the logic behind to it. I couldn't think about it at this time, but, you know, if you guys have time, yeah, go ahead. It's not going to have the time, for sure.
Oh, man. So with the probability of more heavy rain and flooding in the future, should we be considering adding more water-tolerant plants?
Well, with the forecast of more rain, before we start thinking about in a future for adding more water-tolerant plant, here's a few things I would consider, actually. You know, before the next rain comes in, make sure, you know, you prop up your plant. So if your plants are actually leaning towards the ground, especially the tomatoes, you know, well, at this stage, they're highly vulnerable to many diseases. So give a little bit of a trellis system or prune them or probably stake them so that they get plenty of air movement around to it. And you're going to start to see some lot of powdery mildew, other type of infection happening out. So good air flow movement. It's very clean, very key. At the same time, in the fall, do a good garden cleanup. So you don't want to have all those spores accumulating too much in your soil. So probably, you know, you may want to think about it, doing a little cleanup and bagging up all those infected plants, and you're trashing it. For next year, yeah, you know, I would love to have more water-tolerant or wet-tolerant type of veggie crop, but it's hard to find them, actually. So my best suggestion would be go for raised bed gardening. I mean, I'm so lucky. I have some bunch of raised bed garden, and I've been growing some sweet potatoes to tomatoes and everything. Even though after like 9 inches or 10 inches of rain that we got, my plants are doing fine because thanks to the raised bed garden, they're about like 10 to 12 inches above the soil. So again, you know, and it's also a little bit slightly in a slopy area. So having a proper site, so a location, having a raised bed garden would help. And it may help in avoiding these type of situations.
Easier to work on, too.
Yes, absolutely.
What about, I'm thinking about this rain, and typically, if I'm not mistaken, about this time of the year, we have, if you have strawberry beds or plants, mm-hmm. not a bad idea to do some fertilizing, maybe with a 10-10-10. But I'm wondering if with the rain, if this is a good idea.
Well, that's a good question. And the strawberry plants in the past, we used to recommend to add some fertilizer, and then before you start prepping the bed for the strawberry bed for winter, you do a little bit of a mowing to cut down some of those excess foliage. Now, with the soil being so saturated, and with that, it's a chance of more for rain in the than the coming week. In those cases, you can delay those fertilization because you don't want to see those plants, carrying all those, nutrients, all those fertilizer leaching out, So I think you can delay it. It's not going to do any damage to your strawberry plant. And even if you skip it, that's also fine too. I have some strawberry plants. I only fertilize it only in the springtime. It's still doing fine. And so even if you delay fertilizing it, that's also perfectly fine.
Oh, boy. As we go into the fall season now, in our last couple of minutes here, Vijay, maybe talk about some things we ought to be thinking about as we move into late August and into early September.
With being the temperature right now, as well as the humidity being so high right now, many tomato plants, many in the produce is going to be highly vulnerable to rot diseases. And either it could be in a bacterial rot, or it could be powdery mildew, or even it could be, anthracnose. And in those cases, don't wait for the fruit to completely ripen. Harvest them even if it's actually slightly ripened, and then you can ripen them, inside your kitchen counter table. In that way, you can able to minimize those infections taking place. And again, in the fall, once the harvest is completely done, probably do a good cleanup in your garden bed. If your plants are infected, put them in a trash bag and trash it. And probably the other best thing I would suggest is to, put some cover crop in your soil. Don't let those soil to sit open up, to bear open up. You don't want to have another rain or snow to leach out all your top soil. So you can think about some cover crops like winter oats, winter wheats, to protect your soil from those leaching.
All good tips. And Vijay, it's always a pleasure to have you with us. And we'll hopefully look forward to your next visit. Thank you so much for being with us today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much for the opportunity, Larry. Good to talk to you.
Good talking with you. Vijay Pandian, our guest, horticulture agent and educator for UW Extension in Kenosha, Milwaukee, and Racine counties. Coming up, we're going to turn our attention to native plants and even some classes that you might be able to take part in. That's next. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk here on WPR News. Great to have you along for this edition of Garden Talk. Larry Mueller here. We're turning our attention to native plants right now. Native plants, especially beautiful, I think, as summer turns to fall. Great place to see the transformation is the UW Arboretum. And speaking of the Arboretum, Susan Carpenter is back with us. She's the native plant gardening curator at the Arboretum. She has some information on, of course, on native plants and on some upcoming native plant gardening conference classes and tours. We'll also talk to her about what plants look great in the garden right now. And, of course, take your questions about the classes or maybe about your own native plants. What's your favorite fall spot in the UW Arboretum? Have you taken a class or tour at the facility? What's going on with your native plants? Or maybe you'd like to plant some. Give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Or you could email to talk@wpr.org. Susan Carpenter, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Well, it's great to be here, Larry.
What's looking particularly good in the native garden right now?
Oh my gosh, we have so many flowers this year. Some of my favorites, we're right in a transition time kind of now between the very vigorous summer blooming species and then the later fall blooming species. So we still have some of those summer species blooming, but our flowering spurge is beautiful right now. We have Joe Pye weed towering tall because of the recent rains, and our native grasses, our tall grasses, are really all blooming now. So our switchgrass, our Indian grass, the big blue stem, and the cord grass, a lot of those are exceptionally tall this year. So, yeah, just towering plants.
You know, I was looking at my coneflowers yesterday afternoon, and I tell you, I had, well, I don't know how many. There were bumblebees everywhere on those coneflower plants, and they were even, there were a couple of other insects, one that I couldn't actually identify. They were on the same coneflower.
Right. Yeah, it's pretty crowded on some of those plants with all the, you know, with the native plants, you do have a lot of native insects, and they are, and then the native birds come by, and so it's a really food web going on there, and we've seeing a lot of bees too. We've pretty much been able to see the rusty patch bumblebee on a pretty regular basis. That's the endangered one, and we've seen that one on the remaining culver's root that's blooming, and also on our mountain mint. They really love that one too. So just two more plants that are still in bloom.
Well, it's always fun to watch those insects working away on those plants, that's for sure. Well, you've got a native gardening conference.
We do. We have a one-day native gardening conference coming up on Sunday, September 14th, and that is an all-day conference from 8:45 in the morning till 4:30 with workshops, garden tours, lunch, and a keynote talk. So we have, I just checked the registration earlier this morning, and we have about 5 slots left for that. So I know the registration doesn't technically close until September 4th, but it's actually going to close as soon as that last slot is closed. We will have a waiting list, so people, if they aren't able to get into the conference and they want to attend, we generally do dip into that waiting list, so there'll be instructions on our website as to how to go about getting on that waiting list. But it's a really wonderful conference. We have it in the gardens. We have a lot of the activities. We have an indoor portion and then an outdoor portion. It's just the garden in September is just beautiful, and it's fall, and all the fall colors and all the fall blooming. So it's a really fun day, and we really enjoy, we've got experienced gardeners, but also beginners. So it's really, we really try to provide something for everyone.
Yeah, it's great. And registration, you need to register.
Yes, through our website, arboretum.wisc.edu.
And there's a fee for it.
There is. It's now, we're out of the early bird period, so it's $70 for a regular registration, and students, it's $35.
So it's still a pretty good price when you consider there's also lunch involved.
Yes, there's lunch involved.
Well, we'll talk some more about the some of the areas. Maybe we could just do that. What are some of the sessions? Let's talk.
Okay, yeah. Some of our sessions include designing a native garden. So if you're thinking about the design aspect of it, and then we have planting and managing, which is kind of the actual on the ground kind of work and tips for that. We have native trees and shrubs, which is a whole, its own session. Native plant garden tour. I'm going through some of these sessions that are, some of them are full, so I wouldn't want to encourage people for that. We have one special one this year called Nature Journaling, and that is a really wonderful activity where you'll actually be learning about nature journaling, but also doing some nature journaling outdoors. So that's going to be fun. And I'm doing a session called Garden Questions, which I'm describing to people as it's a whole session where you could come and people will be bringing their own questions. So it's a little bit like talking with you, Larry.
Mm-hmm.
and their own specific questions about their garden, and then that will be in a group discussed so that we will offer, you know, suggestions and you know, maybe answers for them, maybe more questions. But that will be to address, you know, for everyone to learn from everyone else's experience in that session. So it'll be a rather small session to keep it a good conversation going amongst everyone.
Yeah, that's it. Do people bring their own plants sometimes and wonder why is this so sickly looking or anything?
Well,
like,
mostly people bring plants to find out, to verify IDs.
Ah,
and that's fine too. If people want to do that, we can certainly do that. But we'll be in touch with the people who sign up for that session, specifically with some specific, you know, suggestions to make the most of the day.
I was kind of intrigued by the nature journaling, and you've got a couple of people leading that, Ann Pierce and Maddie Smith.
Yes, our education team here has been. They've had experience leading these workshops before, not specifically for gardeners. So they're really excited to kind of tailor this session to the garden itself.
That is very, very cool. That'd be fun to get involved in that one.
Mm-hmm.
What are some of the – I know you have a lot of classes over the course of year. What are some of the highlights coming up in the next month or two?
Well, some of the things that are coming up in September and October that are free would be the fall garden tours, and those are on – we have three more in our garden tour series this year. So on September 20th, we'll have the Native Plant Garden. That'll be a two-hour tour of the fall attractions in the Native Plant Garden. So we'll see the things that we'd expect to see, and I'm sure we'll see some surprises. And then on October 11th, we switch over to the horticultural collection. And our horticultural assistant will lead a tour on conifers, and that's on our conifer collection, which is a spectacular collection. And then on October 18th, our curator, David Stevens, will offer a two-hour tour on fall color, and that will range to wherever he takes you. It'll be wonderful.
Well, there's bound to be a lot of color for sure at that time of the year. It's probably the perfect time of the year.
Absolutely. That's why we schedule it then. It'll be almost too much to see in 2 hours for sure.
I always enjoy driving along the Beltline there.
Yes.
In the fall. In fact, I've got to pay attention to my driving, but the color along the edge there of the Arboretum where it meets the Beltline is always really beautiful.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yes. And then we have some other, I mean, our website has been updated with everything through the end of November in terms of events. So there's a fall equinox walk, a night walk that requires registration, but it's free. So just people should check into that pretty soon if they want to attend that one. And then there are some tours of the Lost City, which is always popular. That's getting on into October. So those also require Eventbrite registration, but all the information is on our website.
Yeah. Well, that Lost City, give the thumbnail version of what was going on there, what the history of that.
Yeah, well, the Lost City refers to the housing development that never really got all the way off the ground, and there's still some, but there's still, you know, they were ambitious about it, so many lots were sold, some houses were constructed. Those are not in the Arboretum, but some other houses that are within the Arboretum's boundaries now were not really finished, or just the foundation was there. So this is a chance for the naturalists who are well versed in this history to show people kind of where was the road, what was this story of this this housing development that never really happened, and just to see, to kind of read the landscape, and to also, of course, you'll be seeing on that tour, you'll be seeing a lot of, you know, late October scenery, you know, like sights and interesting things along the way. So it's not too far from the Arboretum, but it does require a registration for that tour on Eventbrite.
Susan Carpenter, our guest today, the Native plant garden curator at the UW-Madison Arboretum. Questions for her, maybe about native plants, maybe about the courses. I hope you'll join in. The number to call, 800-642-1234, or you could email us, the email address, talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk here on WPR News. We're taking a look at native plants and the UW Arboretum today with Susan Carpenter, who is our native plant garden curator at the UW-Madison Arboretum. It's always great to have her come by and talk native plants with her. You can join in. The number to call is 800-642-1234, or you could email to talk@WPR.org. And let's take a call. Daniel in Stevens Point, thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
Thank you, Larry. I've had a prairie garden for nearly 25 years. And in the past few years, the tall grasses, the big blue stem and the Indian grass have gotten out of control. And it's a small area, and I don't know how to beat them back and maybe replace them with some forbs or perhaps some shorter grasses like little blue stem.
Yeah.
Do you have other plants growing among them, or is it pretty much just the solid grasses?
Well, there are some. I have actually some very healthy lupin in that area, but as summer progresses, there is some lead plant in there that's doing very well. But in terms of some of the other forbs, like black-eyed Susans or some of the other coneflowers, not that much.
Mm-hmm. I can't say for sure if this would work, but one thing we do is with tall grasses. You said it wasn't a very large area. We have some gardens where the tall grasses have seeded in, and of course we need to keep the area short because of the parking lot and the visibility and so forth. So we actually trim those. We just trim them down to the ground. Now, in your case, you don't have an army of volunteers helping you. So what you might do when the grasses are coming up, if you have patches that are pretty much just solid grass, take a weed whacker and cut them down to the ground. And that will allow if it's solid there, that might allow other plants to, seed there, to get started. It'd be a disturbance, basically. When we're trimming, we can be a little more selective because we're just cutting them out. We are leaving the other plants. We have plenty of other plants growing within them. Do you burn the area?
No, that's part of the problem, too. It's we're in the city of Stevens Point.
Okay. Yeah, I'm not suggesting to burn it because the burning will usually tend to increase the grasses that you're talking about. But we have had other questions like this where a grass took over an entire yard planting. And the person, basically what we recommended was the person mow it down. Just mow it down and keep weakening the tall grass so that you could then introduce other plants within it and, get a more, and try to get a more even diversity and introduction of other plants there.
So the weed whacker for now, though?
Well, what we do is just trim them. I mean, we trim them right at the ground we're cutting them with pruners, but we trim them right at the ground, and then the next time that bunch of grass comes up, it's weaker than it was.
Oh,
and then we
okay.
do it again, and then there's room for the other plants.
And do you kind of rake that stuff out, or do you just leave
it? We pull it off if it's going to smother the other plants.
Yeah. Daniel, give that a shot. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call.
Hope it works.
Yeah, I hope it works too. You can join in at 800-642-1234 or email to talk@WPR.org. Renee in Rice Lake emailed to ask if any native plants strangle out other native plants or do they learn to coexist. Renee takes part in the Monarch Watch tagging program through the University of Kansas, and they have encouraged milkweed to grow in their native beds, and they are becoming prolific. Renee is wondering if they will take over the other plants as well as the non-natives planted with them.
Mm-hmm. Well, as far as the milkweed is concerned, we've never planted it common milkweed on purpose in our gardens, but we have it. It comes in on its own, and it does spread by underground stems, so it will spread around in the area. But I don't notice that it takes over. So it grows among other plants. It grows with other plants. It might seem like there's a lot of it, but the other plants don't seem to be suffering from, you know, as long as you have a lot of other kinds of plants. So I would keep, and then also they don't, unlike the grasses that we were just talking about, they don't shade everything around them. So there's room for other plants to be growing right next to them throughout the bed. It is important to have all that milkweed because of the monarch, you know, for the monarch caterpillars to have their food. But you need other plants as well for the monarchs to nectar on, because like right now there's very little milkweed blooming. They don't just visit milkweed flowers. They visit lots of other flowers. And right now we have the monarchs that are in our garden are visiting the liatris, particularly the meadow blazing star is their favorite. And every day there are some flying around visiting that plant. So I would recommend putting some of that in also to go along with the good habitat that you're giving the caterpillars there, Renee. So I would encourage you just to plant more native plants in the area if there aren't very many yet. And if you feel that the milkweed is taking over, I think just nestling other plants with it will work well.
How do those, I've often wondered about the native milkweed or the kind of wild milkweed that we, how, I have some that appeared in my garden. I hadn't been in there, had never been in there, mm-hmm. and suddenly there they were. And I thought, how in the heck did they land in there?
Well, it has a wind-blown seed, so those pods that are developing right now on them, when those split open, each seed has a fluffy wing on it, and it can fly a long way. And if you're collecting the seed, we actually recommend, like someone who's growing it might want to collect the seed of their butterfly weed or their swamp milkweed, or even common milkweed. If you wait until the pods are mature, not quite split open yet, but just about to, and then you split them open and hold on to all that fluffy stuff with your thumb, you can scrape off the seeds into a bucket or a cup without getting the fluff going everywhere. And that way you'll have more control over where the seeds are going. But yeah, they can fly in from everywhere. They do it here all the time. And then they move around, and sometimes you'll have a big clump of it, and then it'll be there for a few years, and then the next year, suddenly it's not there anymore. So they are moving around all the time. That's just a neat thing about native gardens. The plants are always on the move and making seeds and finding the place where they can do best.
Oh, man. You mentioned earlier, sort of in passing, you mentioned volunteers when you were talking to another caller. And like most gardens, the Arboretum really relies on volunteers. What are some ways to help the facility?
Well, we do have a wonderful volunteer program here and all kinds of different possibilities for people at different openings for volunteers. So on our website, we have a section called Get Involved, and there's a volunteer tab there, and that will be laying out the different opportunities there are. So I work with volunteers in the Native Plant Garden. We have volunteers in the Horticultural Collection, and each program has its own schedule and its own, you know, kind of goals and, you know, opportunities for people to join in. We have Saturday work parties that are restoration for the bigger part of the Arboretum. And that's a real variety of, you know, weed control, invasive species control, but it's a great learning opportunity. And that really helps us. So those are just a drop-in program on Saturday mornings from 9 to noon. And they're located in different places for each week of the month. So just check our website again. And it's really a great opportunity, you know, to see different areas of the Arboretum and different restoration projects that are going on. We also have indoor volunteering, like reception desk. And right now, today is our last day of summer camp for this year, but we have volunteers who've been helping out with the summer camp. So there's something for everybody.
there sure is. Well, many people don't realize that the Arboretum features artists every year. Tell us about that.
Oh, yes. We have a gallery, a hallway gallery in our visitor center, and that's a pretty substantial hallway. So there's a juried selection process for the entries, and artists can submit their work, you know, their portfolio for that process. And then we have, so each artist then for the following year, for the coming year, would have a 2-month time slot, and so their work is mounted for 2 months, and then everyone who comes into the visitor center can enjoy it during that time, and can, you know, the artwork always has a nature theme, and but it can be a lot of different media: photography, fabric art, painting, all types of prints, all types of different art is acceptable. So that's a really nice thing. And it's really nice to come, for visitors to come every couple of months and make sure you don't miss one of those exhibits.
Yeah, and they're really beautiful.
They're wonderful.
Wonderful, wonderful exhibits. John, his email is a little off, but the topic maybe, but John was asking if over-the-top grass killers hurt daylilies. I'm not sure.
I haven't had to deal with daylilies in the garden that I work on here, but word gets back to me from people who do deal with daylilies that not very much harms them.
Yeah, yeah.
They're usually rooting them out and repeatedly.
Nancy in La Crosse has a question. Hi, Nancy.
Hi, thank you for your guest this time. I have a native prairie, and it's on a hillside. And one of my most favorite plants, Royal Catchfly, I'm trying to encourage its growth, and I have the same syndrome as they talked about earlier about tall plants. They kind of fall over. And I was wondering if you had any tips on encouraging the Royal Catchfly. It seems like a weak stalk that it grows on.
Yes, it seems, it's kind of, I haven't gardened with that plant particularly. I'm familiar with what it looks like. It seems to me that it might be one, we don't want plants that will overtop it and like completely cover it up, but it seems as though it's a plant that does grow well in community. It wouldn't grow as well by itself. So I would look for plants that are associates of it where it would be growing naturally, and maybe shorter plants. So if you have like tall grasses growing around it, I mean, maybe that's not the situation, but if just to encourage plants that are on the same scale as it, as far as what to plant or what to maybe change up around it.
Yep.
And then I don't know, does it reseed itself or?
It does a little, and I do have it supported, the plants that it helps me to identify where they're at. But I was wondering about in the fall, after the frost, the seed. Is that an effective way also to have it spread?
I would imagine, but as I said, I have never gardened, you know, particularly with that plant. You might be able to check more information about the cultivation of it through like the Native Prairie Nursery website or catalog, and see what they recommend about the, you know, what the dormancy, like, does it have a stratification requirement, and just be maybe do some, if that's the case, do some sowing of it in a tray, a winter sowing of it in a tray, so that you know where the seedlings are, you know, next spring, and then you could move them around or, you know, propagate them a little bit yourself, so that you have a good supply
yeah.
of plants.
Makes good sense. Nancy, thank you very much for calling. And Susan, thank you so much. Always a pleasure. We'll look forward to your next visit. Appreciate it.
Great. Thanks, Larry.
Susan Carpenter, native plant garden curator at the UW-Madison Arboretum, and the new UW Arboretum director, Pat Bolin, will be on the show next Wednesday, as a matter of fact. Always great to have you listening in. Great to have a great team. Our peach expert, Clara Neipert, one of them, Joel Patnod. Our technical directors, Lee Raybert and Jeff Robbins. Our executive producer, Jill Nadeau. I'm Larry Mueller. I have a wonderful time this afternoon listening into all the other good programs. I'm Larry Mueller.